Hello, welcome to the Deep and Durable Learning Podcast. This is the show for anyone who's struggled with the superficiality and short half-life of what passes for education. I'm Mike Gray, and I'm transitioning from nearly 45 years as a professor in higher education into this role of podcast host. This show is not primarily about bemoaning the state of education. Instead, I'll offer a positive, practical vision of how your learning can become both deep and durable. In today's podcast, we're exploring a crucial question for deep and durable learning. What's the difference between being informed and being knowledgeable? We could call today's podcast Confusion Says, pun intended, or Epistemology Part 1. There's a general sense of confusion about the concepts of information and of knowledge, and today we want to get some clarity about these two ideas that are often confused. Let me quote a woman with a PhD in epistemology. She says, quote, "We tend to think knowledge is information, facts, bits of data, content, true statements. We then conclude that gaining knowledge is collecting information. And we're done. Educated, trained, expert, certain." So says epistemologist Esther Meek in her book, A Little Manual for Knowing. Well, if knowledge is collecting information, a little reflection says most of us have lost most of our collection. We've all encountered vast quantities of information, even today, that we no longer remember. Do we know things if we can't remember them? Most of us would say no. Is remembering the only criterion for knowledge? Does remembering mean that we know? We're exploring today epistemology. Epistemology is a branch of philosophy that answers the question of what it means to know. Everyone has a view of what it means to know. Included in epistemology is a related question, which is, what counts as evidence for knowing? And the Oxford English Dictionary includes in the concept of epistemology, quoting here, the distinction between justified belief and opinion, end of quote. So due warning here, we're entering a realm that contains fake facts and just your opinion, as well as the truth. The brain is pretty terrible as an information storage device, although we concoct mnemonic devices and other ways of trying to make it more efficient as an information storage device. On the other hand, it's pretty wonderful as a pattern recognition engine. It is through recognizing and exploring patterns, we can call these concepts or ideas. That's what concepts or ideas are. They're patterns that we've recognized. It's through the exploration of patterns that we have the ability to reason, and I would argue as a result of reasoning, to remember. I want to introduce you in our discussion of unpacking information and knowledge and distinguishing between the two to an acronym. The acronym is DIKUW, DIKUW. If you're interested in exploring this in more detail, the complimentary blog post that complements this podcast contains more information and an important diagram of the progression from D to I to K to U to W looks like. And it is a progression. So let's start with D. The lowest level is D, which is data. Data is the thing that fills spreadsheets. Data needs to be processed if it's to have meaning. And perhaps you've been around long enough to know that computer departments were once called data processing. These days, they tend to be called some variation of information technology. And there is a relationship. Computers are good at storing data, and computers execute software that then processes the data and allows it to be sorted and combined according to algorithms in the software to finally yield information. Let me give you a concrete example. I was recently chosen, would be a polite word, by the Census Bureau to answer a survey follow-up to the census called the American Community Survey. I was told when I opened the thick packet that accompanied it that I was required by federal law to take this seriously, to fill this out expeditiously, and to answer the questions to the best of my knowledge. It turned out to be about a one-hour investment because the American Community Survey asked me all kinds of fairly intrusive questions down to the names and ages of who lives in my house, but also how many rooms are in my house, what the number of bedrooms are, the number of bathrooms, the magnitude of my utility bills, what my homeowner insurance premiums are, whether I have internet access, and on and on and on. I was assured that my answers would not be attached to my name in the storage of the data, but my answers to these questions was part of a growing data set that would then be processed by the federal government to yield information. So you see the relationship there. The data included all the particulars and became the basis of making some statements about the aggregate of each one of those answers from people in my state, in my county, and so forth, to help decision makers, politicians, sociologists, public health individuals, etc., to have information about demographics and poverty and access to healthcare and on and on. So this relationship between data that when processed yields information is something we're used to. And obviously decisions should be made with as accurate an information base as possible. Information then is a form of description, may involve numbers, but ultimately information is a what. It answers a what question, like what's the average income of someone in my county? What is the average number of persons living in a home? is the average number of bedrooms and bathrooms and so forth. It's just a what. It's not a so what. It's not a why. It is hopefully factual. I tried to make my responses as factually accurate as possible. But on its own, information just is. Information, then, is the basis for knowledge, but it is not knowledge. So what does this have to do with learning? This is, after all, the Deep and Durable Learning podcast. And I think here what we find is the difficulty of the status quo, which equates teaching as telling information, dispensing information, collecting information from the students, and learning as remembering the information that was dispensed. In another realm, Google, Alexa, and Siri all function in information retrieval. I have Siri on my phone, and Siri punts fairly often, saying, "Here's what I found," with the implication of, you ask the question, you take it from there. I'm giving you information, so see what's most applicable to answering your question. When we think about the confusion between information and knowledge, there's a stereotype of people who are knowledgeable, brainy individuals, as those who have a weird ability to remember. They know stuff. They vacuum up details that others don't notice or don't think are important. I remember in one of my first jobs, actually my first full-time job in higher education, was getting better acquainted with someone who was the dean of admissions at this institution and who knew me on a superficial level. And one day we were talking and he just broke in and said, "What's my license plate number?" And I said, "How should I know?" And what he revealed after that was he thought I was one of these individuals who was brainy, who had a weird ability to remember stuff and notice details. Well, we've got lots of this stereotypical view out there. For instance, a juvenile book series from the 1960s was called Encyclopedia Brown. And the publisher says in regard to this book series, "Leroy Brown is back in the Encyclopedia Brown series. As Idaville's 10-year-old star detective, Encyclopedia has an uncanny knack for trivia. With his unconventional knowledge, he solves mysteries for the neighborhood kids through his own detective agency." And there you have the linkage. An uncanny knack for trivia and unconventional knowledge. Well, trivia and knowledge are two different things. Remembering and solving mysteries are two different things. I never did read the Encyclopedia Brown series, but I do remember with actually some great fondness the Bullwinkle the Moose series that aired from 1959 to 1964. And there was a character on Bullwinkle called Mr. Peabody. Mr. Peabody actually happened to be a dog. And one synopsis of the character of Mr. Peabody was the following, quoting, "The brilliant and slightly egotistical beagle known as Mr. Peabody has long been recognized as the world's most intelligent dog, despite his penchant for making the worst puns in the history of wordplay. During his youth, Mr. Peabody was sent to the Canine Academy for the ARFS, Affection, Retrieval, Frolicking, and Sitting, where he was quickly recognized as a puppy prodigy when he recited Friedrich Nietzsche's Beyond Good and Evil by memory in Latin, Russian, and his native tongue, dog. Well, being able to recite by memory is a very different thing than having knowledge of Nietzsche's argument, even if it's notable that you can pull this off in Latin, Russian, and dog. So we're sneaking up on a cultural stereotype is what we're dealing with, and an erroneous cultural stereotype is the point that I'm making. Knowledge makes use of information. It puts information to work. It is not just remembering information. Knowledge answers a how-to question. Here's another example of the linkage between information and knowledge, and this one comes from evidence-based medicine, which is a phrase trending these days that I've always found slightly amusing. If today we have evidence-based medicine, the practice of medicine previously was based on what, is the question that naturally occurs. Well, let's put that aside, and I'd like to explore for a moment the book Better, just one word, Better, by the surgeon Atul Gawande, who's actually an excellent writer. I would recommend his books to you, including an important book called Being Mortal. But in the book Better, in a chapter on the bell curve, where he traces the incidence of surgical complications following various medical interventions, and one that stuck out was hernia repairs. How often does a particular physician or hospital system encounter complications after hernia repairs? Somewhat surprising to Gawande, the outcomes, complications, which he found from collecting information that was reported to governmental agencies, showed a bell curve distribution. In other words, if you went for hernia surgery, there were physicians who had below average competency as judged by having above average complication rates. There were individual physicians, surgeons who had average rates of complication. There were exceptional physicians or medical practices or hospital systems who had were exceptional in that they had very few complications. And so Gawande, intrigued by this, explored more as a surgeon himself about how they actually went through the whole process from analyzing who needs hernia repair to the procedures used, the follow-up of patients, and so forth and so on. This information then leads to what's often called best practice. And it's interesting here that we do have a bell curve. Not to be too personal, but I've had a hernia repair. And I had some idea about the possibility of complications. So I actually sought out a student of mine who's been a surgeon in my city for several decades, who is well known in the city as one of the most accomplished surgeons around. So he did my surgery, and after a convalescence period, I've had zero complications, and that's been more than a decade ago. On the other hand, I have a neighbor up the street who had somebody else as a surgeon. I have no idea exactly who, but she had procedures done at least three times. The second and third times were because the surgery was not properly done the first time, and reinforcing fabric moved around, and finally they had to do the surgery over again two more times, as I recall. So what we've got here in this evidence-based medicine that leads to best practice is collecting detailed information about different surgeons and their approaches to a procedure like hernia repair, gathering information, and then using the information to make a judgment about what is best practice. Now, eventually, it shouldn't just be that information points to such and such an approach as best practice, but we should eventually explore the question of why this best practice is best. And this question of why is an even more significant question. And Gawande addressed it in his book. And I assure you that we will get there in discussing that, but it'll be next season in this podcast. The idea here then today is information is not the same thing as knowledge, that to be informed is not the same thing as being knowledgeable. So here's a clue. We can look at the etymology of the word to inform. If we look up this in the Oxford English Dictionary, we find, of course, information is a thing. But information is a thing that's used to inform. It's a process, if you will, of informing, using information, a thing. It's a process that leads to, or at least has the potential to lead to, knowledge. The etymology is actually from a 12th century old French word that means inform, means to mold, to literally to form in the person is the implication. So knowledge is not mere transfer and retention of information. Knowledge is gained as we are informed by the molding process of information being brought to bear. Information is a resource with the potential to form the thinking of a person. It's a shaping or a molding influence that changes the person. When someone negotiates with information, they don't just collect it. They've not just been provided with facts of which they were previously ignorant. They have actually been molded, shaped, changed. So, in conclusion, knowing is personal. Knowing requires a knower, an individual, a human. Knowledge is not a commodity that can be bought and sold. The knowledge economy is a misnomer. You can hire knowers who will bring their knowledge with them, and those knowledge bearers, those knowers, will continue to learn on the job to the benefit of your company. This podcast is designed to help you to become a knower. Knowers are valuable to their employers, and they experience deep satisfaction because they're growing as individuals. Knowing as Justifiable Belief is the topic we'll explore on the next podcast. Join me in 2 weeks for Epistemology Part 2, Coming Out of the Fog. In the meantime, contact me at deepanddurable.com. Deepanddurable, A-N-D, deepanddurable.com with comments or to sign up for my biweekly blog.